Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Alice Friedman. She's the granddaughter of two scientists, and she's genetically predisposed to do extensive research and exhaustive reading. Much of this was accomplished as she read while walking 10 miles round trip between home and office. She was a systems architect and engineer for over 25 years. She retired from Dilbert Land to devote more time to science writing on energy, ecology, climate change, whole grains, agriculture, infrastructure, pollution, and too many other topics to list. See her website, www.energyskeptic.com. The past few years, she's come to see that fossil-fueled Western civilization will likely collapse from dozens of factors, especially oil, the master resource that makes all others possible, especially in transportation since heavy-duty trucks, locomotives, and ships depend on diesel fuel. Manufacturing is also completely dependent on the high heat fossil fuels can generate to make cement, steel, microchips, glass, ceramics, bricks, and other essential products. Today we talk about her new book, Life After Fossil Fuels. And so first, thank you for, subtitle by the way, A Reality Check on Alternative Energy. So first, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program. And third, thank you for the excellent interview you gave me, three years ago that was very important to my thinking. So thank you for all of that.
Oh, you're welcome.
So let's talk about your new book. What is Life After Fossil Fuels about?
Well, I start with the premise that electricity is just one of the ways we use fossil fuels. And yet all you hear about is, you know, wind and solar and nuclear to replace electricity. But what about the other 80% of the ways we use fossil fuels? I delved into transportation in my first book, When Trucks Stop Running, Energy and the Future of Transportation. And I talk about that again. That's the main thing you have to have because you don't have manufacturing. You don't have anything else without getting goods to where they need to be delivered. But then this book goes also into manufacturing, which is essential to making everything around you. It goes into how fertilizer keeps 4 billion of us alive or more. I even question whether the electric grid can stay up with just wind and solar. And 500,000 products are made out of petroleum. So there's numerous things that need to be fixed, and I go into each one. Well, can hydrogen replace fossil fuels? Can power to gas? Can ammonia? Can nuclear? Electricity? You know, coal to liquids? In each of the six main areas, I look at how are we going to substitute something else for fossil fuels? And then I look at biomass, which is the only truly renewable energy source, just as it was for all past civilizations for thermal heat, and whether that could replace fossil fuels. That's the grand overview.
So you just said that, that wood is the only truly renewable fuel, and a lot of the sort of mainstream climate activists like Suzuki or McKibben or Klein or Jacobson would disagree with that, and they would say that wind and solar are renewable and that dams are renewable, hydro is renewable. And so can you talk about why you would make that distinction?
Well, first of all, in the energy community, biophysical economics, whatever you want to call it, we call them rebuildables because they aren't renewable. They're built out of material things that require fossil fuels for every single step of their life cycle. You need fossil fuel mining trucks off the grid to get the ores that need to be crushed, shipped to a crushing facility and then to a smelting facility. And then for wind turbines, you have to make 8,000 different parts all over the globe. And then you have to get them to the assembly factory. And then you have to deliver the wind turbine over roads made of asphalt, which is a part of crude oil, and use these tremendous cranes with huge diesel engines to lift the segments of the turbine into place, and cement trucks to have poured the foundation. So there's absolutely nothing renewable about a wind turbine, and the same goes for the steps in a solar panel. And they can't reproduce themselves. So that gets us back to transportation. If ideally you'd electrify it if wind and solar are the solutions, or hydropower. And of course dams wear out in 60 to 200 years and cause a tremendous amount of CO2 release. And they harm ecosystems and fisheries and whatnot. And only 10 states have 80% of hydropower. So it's not even useful most of the country. And even where it is, it can only be released part of the year because you need to store most of it for agriculture and cities to drink, drinking water and, ecosystems and fisheries. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so all of this is why there are some people who call the, wind, solar, et cetera, they call them alternative fossil fuel energy. Because as you're making clear, it takes fossil fuels to make them at every stage of the process.
And they have very short lifespans. Realistically, solar is 15 to 25 years. Offshore wind is 15 years because it takes a tremendous beating from corrosion, rust, big waves, hurricanes, windstorms and the like. And onshore wind is only 20 years. And a lot of the blades are not recycled and they're filling up landfills. And there are a lot of work to try to cut up if you were going to try to reuse them, or, you know, the energy to recycle the blades is probably more than you'll get out of the wind turbine itself.
So we hear often that Los Angeles has committed to going to 100% renewable energy, and Munich has committed to 100% renewable energy, and X number of cities. And I just want to underscore, as you said earlier, that when they say 100% renewable energy, they actually mean 100% quote renewable electricity. That they're intentionally or unintentionally confusing energy and electricity. And so, one, can you make that distinction more clear? You know, you mentioned that electricity is only 20% of total energy use. Can you really bring that home? And then after that, the next question I'm going to ask is, I want you to really make clear, you know, you've given us an overview, but can you really make it inescapable how profoundly dependent on fossil energy or fossil fuels, whatever you want to call them, this culture is? You know, you said all the products made out of plastic. Just step back and just make it so nobody can misunderstand this. So first, electricity versus energy, and then make clear the dependence of this culture on fossil energy.
Well, first, I like to do really concrete things. So take concrete, for instance. There's no electric way to make cement and concrete. There isn't. There's just no way to do that. And yet, you know, look out your window. That's the backbone of civilization, the bridges, the roads. And there's not really an electric way to make steel. You can recycle some steel, but 80% of it is still made from scratch because most places don't have enough electricity or enough steel to recycle. And the steel is downcycled, so it's not usable for all purposes. It was built to be bendable or super strong, or it had some other alloys originally for a purpose that it will be lost for many uses after you've, recycled it with an electric arc furnace. So then how are you going to even get the steel or cement components to a manufacturing place if you don't have really heavy-duty trucks? And I'm talking Class 8 and above trucks that do the work of civilization. In When Trucks Stop Running, my first book, I show how civilization would crash within a week if you didn't have trucks, because as we've seen with even COVID-19, grocery stores get many deliveries a day and the shelves will empty within a day or two if the trucks don't keep coming with the goods. And the same for pharmacies, restaurants, hospitals, factories, any business you can name. The gas stations would run out of gas. They get a fuel truck coming every few days.
But I got really interested in COVID, early on when they shut down Wuhan. And I believe it was 2 days later, a Hyundai factory in South Korea, shut down. And that struck me as absolutely extraordinary that and it doesn't matter why it was locked down. It could have been a war. It could have been an earthquake. It could have been, you know, it doesn't matter. But the point is that cutting off the access between Wuhan and a city in South Korea, like 2,000 miles away, shut down the factory literally within 2 days.
Yeah, I mean, the COVID brought out how the supply chains are so just in time and fragile that they can easily break down. The thing is, you can't, the trucks run on diesel and diesel only pretty much. So I showed in When Trucks Stop Running and the latest book that they can't be electrified because batteries are so heavy that they'll go over the roadway and destroy the roads. And they can't run on coal to liquids because coal is finite, natural gas is finite, hydrogen is explosive. A hydrogen gas station would be $75 million each. We don't have hydrogen fuel cells that work yet. There's really catenary is far too expensive, billions and billions of dollars. And then they have to run on two different – they have to be able to have – a pantograph connecting to wires overhead, and they have to be battery operated or hydrogen operated because they have to get on and off the wire to deliver, pick up cargo, get around obstacles or slow trucks. And that, you know, you're talking a $500,000 vehicle or more for that. Plus the infrastructure is like, it's $90,000 a year just to maintain the wires overhead because they tend to break down. And don't do well in icy weather or rain or, other high winds. So basically, if you can't electrify trucks or run them on anything else, that's civilization as we know it would end, let alone mining trucks, logging trucks. If you ran out of diesel before a harvest, all the crops would rot in the field. Fire trucks, garbage trucks. To a huge extent, you know, they're what replaced horses. I'm not talking about the all electric or hybrid medium sized delivery trucks. That's not going to save civilization from collapse by any means. And there's very few of those. Anyhow.
Why not? We always hear UPS has pure solar powered trucks. And what they don't tell you is they have a range of 50 miles or something. Why won't the solar powered truck save us? Save civilization, not us.
Well, first of all, a huge amount of trucks we depend on are off the grid. You know, mining, logging, firefighting, utility, wire maintenance trucks. They're not anywhere near the grid. And the tractors and harvesters are on a very thin grid. There's not enough electricity to charge them all up in just a few weeks of planting or a few weeks of harvest. And they'd be too heavy. They would compact the soil so much that crops would be permanently reduced in how much could be produced. So if only those little delivery trucks were what mattered, they also cost twice or more what a diesel truck costs. So the only companies that have them are subsidized from the clean air programs, mainly in California and New York, for the difference between the cost of a medium delivery truck and an equivalent diesel truck. let alone that we don't have enough materials. You know, our laptops, our solar panels, wind turbines, computers, microchips, cell phones, they use like 100 of 118 minerals, and we're already seeing the peak production of many of them, or within the next, you know, 5, 10, 15, 50 years, those will be, meanwhile, even if, you know, copper or whatever is available, the ores are declining in quality at the same time as energy is about to decline, and the worse the ore, the more energy you need to get the metals and minerals out. So you're not going to be able to make those medium duty trucks, solar panels, wind turbines, and so on, just from the sheer shortage of the various minerals required, many of which don't substitute for each other. Most of them don't substitute for each other, especially the rare earth metals.
So everything, I'm going to go off topic here, but everything you're saying makes perfect sense and is not particularly cognitively challenging. And I don't mean that as an insult, because I say that the same is true for most of my work. It's not particularly cognitively challenging. I mean, all you have to do is look at, I mean, everything you're saying makes perfect sense. That's all I'm saying. Yet it goes against everything we hear all the time in the media. Can you talk about your perspective a little bit? And then I want to get back to more of back in your wheelhouse. But can you talk for a moment about why you think it is that your analysis, your great analysis, is not on the front page of the New York Times every day, because it's one of the most important topics that exists. I mean, you'd think when the entire society is built on this, and it is A, finite, and B, incredibly harmful to use, you would think that the responses to it would be commensurate with what we're facing.
Well, that's a book in and of itself about why that's going on. I'd say I've been involved with two peak oil task forces for the city of Oakland, San Francisco. Portland had one. Many cities developed when the local level government realized what was going on. They formed task forces, but at the same time they said, wait, you're telling me you have a problem for which you have no solution, because obviously the solution is to consume less. No one wants to hear that. They won't get reelected on that. Jimmy Carter said we need to put on more sweaters and conserve for future generations. And Mr. Morning in America, Reagan, came along, and that was the end of that kind of thinking. So politicians don't really like to address it because it's not a solvable problem, and it makes them sound grumpy, and people don't believe them anyhow. My God, you look at QAnon. I would say a lot of why there's not more awareness is the Americans are particularly scientifically ill-informed compared to the rest of the world, and mathematically challenged, and even literacy challenged. You know, we're at the bottom of the developed countries, even though we're the wealthiest country that's ever existed or ever will exist, because of our fossil fuels and other resources. So there's tremendous pressure against speaking out on it. And then I also see the problem is climate change has dominated everything. Rockstrom and others wrote about there's 9 different boundaries we must not cross or we risk extinction. And climate change is just one of them. We're driving species extinct, biodiversity, the nitrogen cycle's out of hand. The there's so many other ozone depletion. There's so many other areas. And so, the New York Times mentioned climate change 15,000 times in the past 5 years, and they only mentioned peak oil 9 times. So the awareness, isn't there for the public. I have a post, called Why Do Political, Economic, and Environmental Leaders Deny, Peak Oil, Climate Change, and so on, that has like about 60 more reasons, why this isn't being addressed. But that brings me to maybe the main point, what I should have made at the outset, which is that time is running out. There are independent energy agencies in Europe and the United States that are not political. They're there to inform their government of the status of energy. And the European Energy Agency stated that in 2008, conventional oil peaked in production. And that's where
I'm sorry. Can you talk about what that means? Peak oil, the energy production peaked. Please explain that for people who this might be the first time they've heard it.
Sure. Since 1860, when the first oil well was drilled, you know, you look at a chart and it goes up and up and up and up and up. Now we know that the earth isn't a giant gas tank periodically refilled by the petroleum god. So at some point, there's going to be a peak of oil production worldwide, and then it's going to start to drop in production. That doesn't mean we're out of oil. It means we have half the oil, although it's more difficult oil to get out that will take longer. But, you know, we've reached the halfway mark once oil peaks, and then you're going downhill. Well, once you start going downhill, you're in big trouble. When I'm old enough to have been in college in the first two oil crises, and the government came up with a rationing plan to try to cope with what was thought back then to be the peak of oil production, which turned out not to be true. But the plan back then was to allocate everything agriculture needed off the top, and only after then would other critical entities be rationed oil with the public at the bottom. So we have reached the top. We, according to the European International Energy Agency, conventional oil peaked in 2008, and the United States Energy Information Agency included unconventional oil and conventional, and they say that oil production worldwide peaked in 2018. And they also included tar sands, fracked shale oil, and deep sea oil. So think about it. You want fusion power? Good luck. You've got, 10 years, 20 years left, before, things really start to go radically downhill, because there's likely to be wars and, other problems. It's declining really steeply. 80% of oil is declining at 8.5% a year. However, 4% of that is offset now by existing oil wells just maintaining their property, like obtaining CO2 to push oil up towards the surface to harvest it. But that amount of the rate of decline keeps increasing exponentially. On top of that, we haven't hardly found much oil the past 7 years. And where are you going to get it? About a quarter of the remaining oil is in the Arctic, but we still don't know how to get it, because icebergs will mow over any oil that we're getting out in the ocean. And the permafrost prevents us from building roads and other infrastructure to get at oil there for the most part. And it's super, super duper expensive. It's just downhill from now on. There's no time left to really build nuclear power plants or scale wind and solar up or, figure out hydrogen or wave power. There's so many options that are not commercial now. you know, the Gen 4 nuclear, not commercial, fusion, not commercial, hydrogen, not commercial, wave power, tidal power, power to gas, myriad others are still not commercial. Cellulosic ethanol, not commercial. We never figured out how to make it, and it's not really a surprise because plants spent hundreds of millions of years evolving so that critters and pests couldn't eat it. And so the lignocellulose is really, really hard to break down. And scientists have tried everything. They smash it. They put toxic chemicals on it. They fry it with radiation. It sounds like plant torture when you look at all the ways they've tried to break the cellulose down to get the sugars out to make ethanol, which, by the way, does nothing for you because trucks can't run on ethanol. They can only run on diesel. They can't run on diesel haul. They can't run on gasoline. So ethanol and cellulosic ethanol are pretty much a waste of time and energy. So we're out of time. So no matter what I say, think about it. We're out of time. Even if I don't convince you that, wind and solar and hydropower and nuclear aren't renewable, it's tick tock.
So, I just want to add in, you're talking about all these different forms of energy being not commercial, and you mentioned wave energy, and I just want to add in that all of those, as well as being not commercial, they all have their own environmental costs as well.
Yes.
I mean, nothing is free that way.
I mean, and then I would say one of the biggest things in my book that gets back to this whole thing is manufacturing. There was very little research that I could find on how you would electrify manufacturing. That's where over half of fossil fuels are used. And yet, nobody has really been looking at how would you electrify manufacturing.
Wait. Let's get really basic on this because I actually want to understand it. So you have a factory, and I understand if you have a coal-fired plant to use electricity to run the conveyor belts and everything else. And I also understand if you have a coal-fired burner to heat the plant, physically heat the plant. You have a big oil or coal burner in the basement that heats the plant. I understand both of those. But why else would you need non-electricity forms of energy for manufacturing?
Well, basically fossil fuels are the only way to generate up to 3,200 degrees Fahrenheit heat in order to make cement, steel, iron, bricks, glass, microchips, and many, many other products.
So you basically have to, you have to have an oven that is burning a physical property. You can't do it through simply running electricity through a wire.
No, maybe there's a way to do it. I don't know. Tick tock. Nobody's come up with it.
I'm not challenging you. I'm just trying to understand.
No. And I want to go into that more. So basically there aren't processes to make goods with electricity, and that would be a terrible way to make heat. It's three times more energy efficient to burn fossil fuels directly. And here's another thing. Even if an electric process was invented to make cement, the current U.S. electric grid is spectacularly mismatched for the job because two-thirds of the electricity is generated with natural gas and coal. And they lose two-thirds of their energy as heat trying to generate electricity. They lose another 10% of electricity over the wires. So you're only getting a quarter of the energy contained in the fossil fuels at the factory. And so then it's like, well, why don't we use geothermal? Well, no, that only gets up to 380 degrees. Nuclear power only gets up to 572 degrees. A solar parabolic trough up to 752. So, you know, let's say you came up with some way to generate high heat that I haven't mentioned. Then what? You're going to move the factory next to the Gen 4 nuclear power plant? Because heat doesn't travel. It doesn't travel far at all. And you can't store the heat. You would have to move every damn factory in the world next to a few hundred nuclear power plants or whatever contraption you came up with.
Thank you so much for this. You're really helping me understand this. So the way I know almost nothing about cement factories, except that they're in these big kilns, I think. So, and they also put out a lot of smoke. So what happens inside a cement factory is they burn oil, they burn coal or something that
they burn coal, to make it. And the coal also gives the concrete better properties than wood charcoal would. Wood charcoal would be another way to do it, but the quality of whatever's made with charcoal isn't nearly as good as it is with coal.
So basically they take a truckload of coal. Of course, the truckload is driving on diesel. A truckload of coal, they dump it in the building, and then they scoop it into a big furnace, and then that is used to heat up the materials that are used to make cement. Is this the cement making for dummies version?
Yeah, and the kilns are really, really huge, which makes them hard to electrify as well. And they can run for 20 years. And they have to keep running, because if they ever stop, then it breaks the brick lining inside. And so just imagine intermittent electricity trying to make something like cement or something where the kiln has to stay hot and run all the time. That's true with chemical factories and other factories that are around the clock. If the electricity ever stopped, then the substances in the tubes and the canisters would harden up, and there goes the whole factory. That happens with microchips. If you had an electric failure even once, they take 4 months to make, and all the chips in progress, tens of millions of dollars worth, are thrown out. The wind and solar is really a bad idea when it comes to manufacturing, because there's quite a few industrial processes that are done around the clock.
This is so fascinating to me. So again, just to be clear, what you're saying is those processes require, for thermodynamics reasons, they require the burning of materials as opposed to generating it through electricity, for all the reasons you've just said.
Exactly. And so then hydrogen is the other favorite, but I see that as the dumbest alternative energy of all. It has no energy. It's like a battery. You have to put energy into it, and a lot of energy that you will never get back. And it's pretty much all of it's being made from natural gas right now. So, but if you want to make it from water, it can't be from seawater, because that releases chlorine gas and kills off all the workers. So you're going to use fresh water and compete with agriculture and droughts and the draining of aquifers. All right. So it takes California uses 20% of its energy to move water around. So now you're moving water to a plant where there's an electrolyzer. So it's going to take, but you have to purify hydrogen because it will clog up a fuel cell. So it's going to take 18 tons of water to produce 9 tons of purified water. Then you're going to use more energy to get it to the catalyzer. And from the 9 tons of water, you'll get 1 ton of hydrogen. And then you have to compress it or liquefy it to minus 422 Fahrenheit and keep it cold, which takes energy. And then you're putting it in very expensive steel alloys that take longer to corrode and embrittle than regular steel, but eventually they will break. And then hydrogen's 12 times more explosive than gasoline vapor, and it's going to catch on fire. And I can assure you most manufacturers are not going to want to put hydrogen inside their factories to run whatever operations that they're running, if it could even be done. There's a steelmaker, Exceller, that has said, well, theoretically, you could make steel with hydrogen, but it would take almost $1 trillion and several decades to scale up the wind and solar to produce the energy for the electrolyzer. So they're pretty much saying that it's not going to happen in a nice way.
I don't know why you're so worried about the use of water for this, because it's not like rivers no longer reach the ocean or aquifers are being drained or anything like that. I'm being sarcastic.
Right. Don't dams hold back half of all water at this point? It's some crazy amount.
Oh, I haven't heard that, but that wouldn't surprise me. I do know that 25% of the rivers in the world no longer reach the ocean.
Yeah, that's right. Probably the Colorado River is one of them.
Oh, it absolutely is one of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
how are wind and solar going to make themselves? They can't run trucks and they can't run manufacturing facilities. The manufacturers, if let's say some green energy country said, no, you got to use hydrogen or electricity, they operate on razor thin margins internationally. They would either go out of business or they would move to a country that still had fossil fuels. So it's economically not going to happen, let alone physically from the fact that there's no way to do it. There's little time left to even figure out a way to do it if peak oil did indeed peak in 2018. If nothing else, we're near the end of the age of oil because it's been on a plateau since 2005.
And I just want to point out to listeners who may be going, but there's still, they got shale oil, they've got deep sea oil, they've got, you know, these other recovery methods. I just want to point out that that is not a symbol of a lack of peak oil. That's actually a symbol of peak oil, because if the easily accessible oil weren't gone, you wouldn't bother. You know, I got a degree from the Colorado School of Mines in 1983. My was when my degree, when I graduated. And so I was there from 79 to 83, and they talked a lot. School of Mines is a energy school, basically. And they talked a lot about shale oil, and they were very explicit that shale oil is useful, but it's completely absurd to try to get shale oil when you can just scoop it up in Pennsylvania, or when you can just drill for it in Texas or Kansas. And only when those reserves are gone or no longer economically feasible do you move to the more challenging types. So the fact that there is deep sea oil drilling and there is all this other expensive oil extraction technology, that is an indicator that the easy stuff is gone, because nobody in their right mind would get the hard stuff when you can get the easy stuff.
That's you hit it, the nail on the head. That's exactly right. And shale, one of the reasons we had peak oil in 2018 is that the fracked shale oil peaked. And unless you constantly are adding new oil wells to drill for it, it declines at a rate of 80% a year. So they're just running to stay in place right now, and it's still declining.
So you have said several times, the single most common words you've said in this interview, I think even more often than diesel, are TikTok. So can you talk about TikTok a little bit more? And then my next question is going to be, if they made you energy czar for this country or for the world, what would you do?
Okay, well, a huge TikTok is that the natural gas fertilizer that keeps at least 4 billion of us alive is going to go away, because natural gas is finite, and it's destroying, it's one of the planetary boundaries. It's causing nitrous oxide which is 300 times more global warming than CO2, and it depletes ozone. And, boy, you don't want to live on a planet without ozone. You couldn't slather on enough sunscreen, I don't think, to protect against that. So the only way we can replace natural gas fertilizer is to go back to organic agriculture and composting, just as we did in the past. And industrial agriculture, even if peak oil wasn't going to be the cause of our downfall, since it's the master resource that makes all others possible, even if that weren't true, we're already destroying the planet with industrial agriculture, eroding the soil, pumping up, half our food is grown from fossil aquifers, the Ogallala and the California aquifers, half our food. And those are emptying out. So we have to get back to organic farming. Also, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, you name it, are made out of oil. And we've run out. We literally are running out, just like we are with antibiotics. So we have to figure out how to grow food without pesticides, which would be super because it's just poisoning the landscape. And we used to lose a third of the crop to pests before pesticides, and we're still losing a third of our crops with pesticides and poisoning the earth and land and water with it. So that is a tick-tock on nitrogen fertilizer. It's a tick-tock if I haven't convinced you that wind and solar won't work. Then just consider that they're not always up. We all know that. So their energy has to be stored. Well, there's only three ways to do that. You could build more hydropower dams. Oh no, you can't actually, because all the good spots are taken. So you could build compressed air energy storage. Well, no, you can't. There's only one in the United States and one in Germany, and they're very small. And you need a salt cavern 1,800 to 4,500 feet under the earth, and those are not easy to find. There's only three Gulf states and a little part of Utah that has them. So then you could build a giant electric battery. Well, when trucks stop running, I calculated based on scientific research, because none of this is me. I'm also always constantly citing peer-reviewed research, that the only materials on Earth which there's enough of to make a battery to store just one day of U.S. electricity, and you'd need 30 days of storage because wind and solar are seasonal, you'd need 945 square miles to contain the sodium-sulfur battery and $41 trillion, and then you'd have to replace it in 15 years. And I do the same calculations for lithium and lead acid. They don't come out well either, and there's not enough materials for them anyhow. And the lead acid only lasts for 5 years before you have to replace it. So that's tick-tock. Don't have manufacturing ways to do without fossil fuels. Don't have ways to do transportation without fossil fuels. And here's another biggie. 500,000 products are made out of petroleum. So, carpets, clothing, asphalt, plastics, umbrellas. I mean, you name it. You look around you, it's probably got petroleum product in it, the finish on your table. And the only thing that could replace that is biomass, because after all, petroleum is a biofuel. It was created from 200 tons of plants per gallon of gas that you put in your car.
Wait, what's that number again? Tell me that number again.
It's something like 196,000 pounds of plants over tens of millions of years produced 1 gallon of gasoline.
No wonder it's so energy dense.
Yeah, and so we're burning. This is why biomass doesn't scale up, because biomass is the answer to every single one of these problems, theoretically. But it doesn't scale up to 8 billion people, with 3 billion more on the way by 2050, because we are burning the fossil fuels we burn equals 400 times as much as new plant material produced worldwide, including the phytoplankton and microscopic plants in the ocean. Biomass won't scale up. And yet, My book makes the case that we are indeed going back to a world of wood like all the civilizations before then, because we don't have something that can replace fossil fuels. And we will again be using wood as our main source of thermal energy. And we will make, you know, a millionth of the amount of steel, cement, and whatever we're making now, because biomass doesn't scale up.
So you are declared, tomorrow, you are declared the energy dictator of the world. I'll say first, if I were declared energy dictator of the world, the first thing I would do is outlaw, golf courses and lawns and retractable stadium roofs and stuff that's really easy that are complete luxuries. And then after that, I'd move to harder and harder stuff. So that's my short version. What would you do? Oh, well, the other thing I would do is I think soil is the basis of terrestrial life. And so I would, insist that all landowners, do whatever is necessary to improve the soil on their land. Anyway, so now I'll shut up. What would you do?
I like your solutions. I'll have to add some of them to my what to do list. I already mentioned organic agriculture. If we're going back to a wood world, 80 to 90% of us are going to be farmers. Might as well get going on that now, given the few decades we have left. We could make it fun by having, sort of a living history, kind of thing where there'd also be trades learned, like how to make leather goods, how to, do iron, smithing and all that kind of thing too. It could be almost like a, you know, a program like the Peace Corps or something where, people that are like 18 do a year of service and learn how to all these old fashioned skills, which are going to become more and more important. Then I'd say number two is you need to have rationing plans ready to go. And Stan Cox, has a book called Any Way You Slice It that's just wonderful and the best book on rationing I know of. And, many steps beyond the Department of Energy 1980 gasoline rationing plan. I'd say number three is family planning. The carrying capacity of the United States without fossil fuels is 40 to 100 million people. And worldwide, it's probably 1 billion people. So you'd really want to make birth control and abortion free, tax more than one child, that sort of thing. I know that won't happen, but I have to say it.
Here's something that just kills me, is that I get accused, because I write about how this culture is not sustainable, the first response so often is, oh, you want to kill 6 billion people. And my response is always, no, I want for us to face the predicament, because the population will be lower and every cell in my body wants for that to be as little pain as possible. So the more we prepare, the better we'll be. And you're the one who wants to go full speed ahead and, you know, basically forget every future generation.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, a lot of people have written about the whole capitalist system is built on endless growth, which was only made possible by fossil fuels. Before that, we were in a steady state because there's only so much land to produce stuff. So we're just taken for granted that we're going to keep growing. And our economic system is not so much based on money, but credit and debit. So you borrow money because the lender knows you're going to be able to pay it back because you're going to grow. And so, I hope someone, I'm Herman Daly. There's probably people that have come up with a steady state system, but that, like the rationing, needs to be ready to go because we're not going to keep growing. I would build more permanent infrastructure for, our future, generations, like Roman roads of stone, which still exist over 2,000 years later. Oh, and then another huge one that goes way up at the top is getting rid of nuclear wastes, because future generations won't have the energy to do that, to bury them hundreds of feet underground. And if we don't get rid of the wastes, there's hundreds of thousands of years of toxic radioactivity that our the descendants are going to have to cope with, which is just so wrong and unfair. It's the least we could do for them, especially since nuclear power isn't going to be able to solve any problems anyhow.
So we're running out of time here, in not in the big scale, in the small scale. And so can you give us like a couple things? One of them is, in the last minute, can you sum up for us? And also, can you tell us, A, how people can get your book, B, your books, plural, and B, what website or websites they can go to learn more about your work?
Okay, almost all the material in my book is at energyskeptic.com, but, you know, it's scattered about. However, I have a post called Updates to Life After Fossil Fuels, and within it you can probably more quickly find out which post most comes close to a chapter within the book. I also thought I should mention the good news about the decline of fossil fuels. Over a dozen geologists wrote papers plugging in realistic amounts of fossil fuel reserves into the IPCC models, which do not model the decline of fossil fuels at all.
I know, that blows me away.
In fact, their worst case scenario that everyone thinks is going to happen requires a fivefold increase in coal by 2100. Well, world peak coal probably happened in 2013, and it happened over 10 years ago in the United States, and we had the most coal in the world. So we're not going to, so anyhow, they think that the worst case scenarios were, pathways 2.6 to 4.5. And if oil didn't indeed peak in 2018, it may be the lower one of the two, the 2.6. And keep in mind, the IPCC states that it takes 30 years to remove half of CO2. And then another 30% within a few centuries. And the remaining 20% will stay around for many thousands of years. So climate change is going to continue to get worse, but it's not forever. It's not going to drive us into extinction. And we don't have to worry about robots and artificial intelligence either, because there's no energy to do that. As far as getting my book, Springer sells it, and it'll take you to the European site unless you specifically ask for United States. And then they'll charge you $30 for delivery. So Amazon sells it the cheapest. And yes, they're the evil empire, but they have the lowest prices that I know of for my book.
So one last thing, and I hate it when people ask me this. So I'm sorry, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want, but you talk about, you know, TikTok. When do you think, I know again, this is a sucker's bet, but when do you think that the trucks will probably start faltering, and when do you think that that stuff will that the grocery stores will start emptying a little bit?
Well, I think it'll happen very regionally. Some countries are going to fare worse than others. I think overall we could be down to half of our oil we produce today by 2035, or if the decline rate accelerates, or there's wars, or oil gets choked off in the various oil choke points like the Suez Canal in the Middle East, or there's war in the Middle East, which is where two-thirds of the remaining oil is. Two-thirds. You can't count on Russia to produce more. They're a corrupt mafia totalitarian state. And they're on the edge of the decline of their oil. So are we. So the Middle East is where it's at. So that's going to – and China has the largest navy in the world. So I think we built our huge military back in the 70s in anticipation of oil shortages, and we're not going to get it militarily. What a waste of the remaining oil. There's so many factors is what I'm saying. But I would say by 2030 – or before, both energy agencies see oil shortages by 2025. But it won't happen overnight.
Well, thank you for giving a sophisticated answer to that. I was hoping that that's what you would say is some sort of, I mean, I shouldn't have hoped because I know you. And so thank you for, as always, giving a sophisticated answer. Last chance. Is there anything else you want to say before we go?
Oh, I'm sure I'll think of it once you hang up, but I can't right now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your great work in the world. I would really recommend that people read this extraordinary book, Life After Fossil Fuels, and your other book. What was it called, When the Truck Stopped Running?
Energy and the Future of Transportation.
Yeah, that's such a good book, too. Anyway, I would like to thank you for that, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Alice Friedman. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.